Hey friends, Jude and John Lovell are back here with another episode of the Book Exchange Podcast. We hope you are all doing well. I feel like we always say this, but it does feel like it's been a little while since we recorded last and had a discussion last. Jude, welcome from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, thank you. It's a nice day here in Pennsylvania. Yeah, it does. I think it's been a few weeks, and also just, you know, in our own lives, we've had a few things going on. So feels like a while.
Yeah, but it is good to be back. I think, we've teased this in various formats one way or another, but our episode today, we're going to do one of our BXC reviews, which we do every now and then, wherein we take on one particular book, be it a novel or a nonfiction book, and we really just kind of dive into it and tear it apart in our discussions. So we're going to do that. In addition to that, this BXC review is of a book that neither of us have read before, and it's an acknowledged American classic. So part of the concept here, and I don't think we've done this with our other BXC review episodes. Normally, with those episodes, we'd like to focus on a book that at least one of us have read, that's a favorite of ours, or that we kind of feel is worth, you know, unpacking for our listeners and for ourselves. This time, it's a bit of a what we call a discovery, you know, episode, in that we decided to take on, as I said, a classic that is very, very well known, but that neither of us, A, had read, or B, knew almost anything about, except for the fact that this particular novel has, you know, long since made its way into American popular culture. I'm talking about Catch 22, which is a war novel that was written and released in 1961 by Joseph Heller. So I would venture to say it's a book that most Americans, not just Americans, many, many people around the world have heard of, simply because the title itself has become, at least in this country, in America, kind of part of our lexicon. It refers to sort of a can't win situation, or a circular situation where you're sort of damned if you do and damned if you don't. But other than being familiar with the title, and familiar with the book just from by reputation, I guess, you know, neither of us really knew anything about this book, did we, Jude?
No, I really didn't. I mean, I had it sitting on my shelf for like a long time, I think I've said in some of our teases of this. And I'm like you, I kind of, like I, well, I guess the only thing I knew that you did not know even this much going in was that it was like a comedic war novel. And I don't think you even really knew that, if I'm not mistaken.
I did not.
Yeah, and but other than that, it was just a term, which, and we can talk about this if we choose to, but like the term is actually, I feel like the term is a little bit misused or dumbed down in the American lexicon.
Uh-huh.
Like I found that the title means something a little bit more complex, but I don't know if we'll get into that or not. It doesn't really matter, but I like the way you explained it though. It's kind of a circular situation, ellipsis, or like where there's like you can't win, damned if you do, damned if you don't. And the other thing I was just going to bring up real quick, it just occurred to me just now, just listening to you introduce this, is that we did have, this is a little bit like this, so we floated some ideas for the podcast for certain series that we haven't used yet. And one of the ones that we've talked about we kind of tentatively titled Undiscovered. And I think we intended that, if I'm not, you know, mistaken of our past conversations, really more of like a writer that neither you or I, like we knew that like we should have read, but we haven't. But this is a little bit like that also, is that, you know, it's kind of an undiscovered book for us. Something we, you know, well, I won't speak for you, but we kind of feel like we should have read already, but we have not. So this is like, you know, the BXC review series, yes, but it's like it's a little different as you were explaining. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, in terms of our listeners, whether you've read the book and are familiar with it, maybe it's one of your favorite books, as we know of at least one person in our family, Jude, you know, or you're like us, you kind of are aware of the book, but you've never read it. You've never really discovered it. You're not sure what it's all about. Hopefully this conversation will appeal to both of those units. And also, it kind of gives us, like you mentioned, Jude, it's a war comedy. So it kind of.
Oh, man, what happened there?
And the fact that there aren't that many really sort of broadly comedic books about, you know, what Talking Heads once called life during wartime. And so we'll get into that, you know, like maybe possibly, you know, what other quote unquote war comedies we might be familiar with, or how this book kind of stacks up against other famous books about, you know, the experience of serving during combat, et cetera. So this discussion will give us a chance to branch out into a bunch of other different directions. So that's our little setup. Unless there's anything else you want to say, Jude, we'll just kind of get right into the show format here.
Well, I do have, you can still hear me, right?
Yeah.
I do have two things I want to mention. First of all, just now the audio went out on me for about 5 seconds and you kept going, came back in. So we'll just keep rolling with it. I'm sorry for the sometime audio difficulties we have, but it might be heard on the podcast, me going, what the heck just happened? So if that came up, sorry about that.
Okay.
But, we'll just roll with it, John. I mean, by now our listeners know that we have some limitations. But I did want to say, can I squeeze in something sort of, that we sometimes call administrative in nature?
Absolutely.
Is that all right?
Yep.
Okay, so I'll just do this quickly. So the last time we were doing a podcast was a Father's Day episode. And after that, we received some feedback from a listener who basically said, John, you know, I like what you guys are doing, but you can't have a podcast that's over an hour. You know, like people just aren't going to listen, you know? And I think you can debate that. And you and I were talking about it. And in general, you and I are of the opinion that, you know, we've always been pretty transparent that the podcasts are going to be long. Believe me, what people are getting at this is the shortened version of our conversations. But I'm just curious if anybody wants to say or ring in on whether they think we should try to go for shorter episodes or have feedback in terms of the length of our podcast that they want to share with us. Would you drop us a line? BookExchangeTwins@gmail.com. BookExchange with the X. XCHANGETwins@gmail.com. Let us know if anybody has strong feelings about that. I just got curious about it after we got that feedback. I don't think you and I, John, I'll let you ring in a second, you know, really had specific intentions to worry about making the episode shorter, but I just thought it was an opportunity to ask people to ring in if they choose to. So there you go.
Yeah, and I think we also, when we were talking about this, we sort of said that, you know, if we hear from some people and there's sort of a consensus or something like it, that maybe shorter episodes would be a bit easier to digest or whatever. I don't think that necessarily means we're going to change the format of our show. I think what we're basically talking about is kind of taking our regular shows and cutting them in half, essentially. So
right.
I just want to make that point. I don't think regardless of what we hear, I don't think we're really not prepared to, you know, change the format of our show. And so we're just going to, you know, divvy it out in chunks if that's what people would like. So, you know, we'll see what happens. Well, you know, I agree. We'd love to get people's feedback on this question, and we're willing to be, you know, to be malleable to some extent. But the show kind of is what it is. And for this show, we're just going to, unless you have anything else you wanted to say there, we're just going to keep moving forward.
Nope, that's it. So let's keep going.
All right. Well, you know how this goes. What are you reading right now, Jude, that you want to tell our listeners about?
Oh, I'm really excited about what I'm reading right now. I've sort of restrained myself from talking a lot about it to you, although I think you know what it is. So I'm reading this. I'm going to preamble it by saying this is definitely a front runner for me of the book of the year.
Nice.
Which would be unusual because it's an anthology, which is kind of like cheating. But I'm, you know, because, I mean, it's got a lot of stuff from a lot of different writers rather than being one book by one writer. But I'm reading this anthology, which, you know, if you know me and you do, it's like right down the pipe for me. But it's so I found this article a couple months ago that just stumbled on it, you know, clickbait or something like that. And it was a kind of a revisitation of an anthology from 1987, I believe it is. And it's a horror anthology, which was meant to be kind of like an evaluation of the state of horror. And it's called Dark Descent, no article. Dark Descent. And it was edited by this guy named William Hartwell. I don't know who that is. But it is a 1,000-plus anthology of horror, short works of horror. But it mingles together like some of the biggest contemporary names, obviously Stephen King, people like Joyce Carol Oates, you know, other people that were contemporary, Peter Straub, stuff, people like that. Also brings in some like people who were more fantasy writers, famous for being fantasy writers or science fiction, that had dabbled in horror, people like Harlan Ellison, you know, and people of that stripe.
Mm-hmm.
But it also mixes in older horror from, you know, from the genre. And I'm talking about people like Poe, but like also contemporaries of Poe that are almost not known at all or little known that I had never heard of. The guy, M.R. James, who I know you're a fan of from like the late 19th century.
Yep.
There's a story I read. And then Lovecraft, like I just read the original Call of Cthulhu, which that story called Call of Cthulhu. And even for Lovecraft, that might be the most insane story I've ever read in my entire life. I mean, it's just bananas. But I'm having such a great time with it. And I'm only like 125 pages in out of 1,000. So it's going to be a really long sleigh ride. But I have to say, John, like I'm really happy.
Hold on. Is that sleigh ride, Slay? Please tell me it is.
Well, it just became that way.
Sleigh ride.
Sleigh ride. Yeah. No. And the other thing about it is I won't go on too much longer, but it's divided into these three sections. I wish I could remember the titles, but the introduction explains what it was trying to do. One of them was called The Color of Evil. And it had a couple other, the other sections are just like something really weird and kind of different. Some writers are repeated. It's kind of like meant to chronicle kind of the evolution of the horror story. And what I'm finding is the guy who edited it, he writes these very brief introductions, but they're all of them have been fascinating. And I'm just really enjoying it. There was a vintage cut, really old cut from Stephen King called The Reach, which was set in New England. And you could feel like Hawthorne and like, you know, old-timey literature kind of informing that. And then it went on to Young Goodman Brown by Hawthorne, which if I read that story, I might have been about 14 or 15 years old. But you can feel that story kind of seeping into contemporary horror works such as The Witch, that film The Witch, John. And like,
yeah,
drawing the connections between these works of fiction and then feeling their reach into other things is really fun for me. And then the last thing I was going to say is there was like, and it's just introducing me to some antiquated voices that you won't hear about anymore that I had never heard of. Some of them were really fascinating. There was absolutely, I thought it was a brilliant story by a woman. I wish I could remember her name from like early 20th century. And it would fit into the kind of fable-ish horror story, like, you know, with little kids. And if they don't behave well, such and such is going to happen. And I think it was called The New Mother. And it was something about these kids living in a cottage with the mother, and then the mother vanishes, and the kids are misbehaving, and then there's this legend that, you know, like if they misbehave, they're going to get a new mother that's made of wood and has like these like weird eyes and stuff like that. And this mother made of wood shows up at the end. I was absolutely enthralled with that story. I thought it was terrifying, you know.
Wow.
So anyway, I'll leave it there. I'm having a great deal of fun with it. I actually cannot wait to read the next 900 pages of this anthology. So that's what I'm reading. So over to you.
Yeah, that sounds incredible. That story that you were just describing there about the mother made of wood, I mean, that seems like custom made for Guillermo del Toro.
Oh, man. It was to do it. It was like 8 or 10 pages, and it was like antiquated style. But man, when that wooden mom shows up at the end, the kids are like, we're blanked.
Oh, man. It might have been an anthology. I want to say I want to say it's Ambrose Bierce maybe wrote the story. I'm not totally sure. I think it may have been him. But it was a story about a guy who plays, you know, it was from like either the very early 20th century or maybe late 19th century. But it was about a guy who's playing chess with an automaton, like basically an early form of a robot. And the robot like murders him at the end of the game or something like that. Like, you know, there was to the point of this anthology, there was that sort of undercurrent of these kinds of stories that were being written at that time, you know, whether it's M.R. James or Poe, or like I said, Ambrose Bierce, you know, that story, the yellow wallpaper that we've talked about before, there's some freaky stuff going on kind of, you know, in the underground. So that's, but that whole anthology sounds like it's just incredible fun. It sounds like I need to have it on my shelf, you know?
Well, and plus I got a print and I got it on like ABE books for like $7. It's just the ultimate kind of thing for me, you know, like a ratty old, you know, didn't cost me much and it's just paying off like a thousandfold.
Right. That's the ultimate book exchange kind of book. No, there's no question.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on mine because I've already brought it up at least once on this podcast before. And what I'm reading is that big, long biography of Frederick Douglass that you gave to me that I mentioned before. It's called Frederick Douglass, Prophet of Freedom. It was a Pulitzer Prize winner, I think, in 2020, maybe, or one of these recent years. And it's by David W. Blight. And, you know, I've been doing some traveling and things like that. My schedule hasn't been, it's been all out of whack in the last 2 weeks. So this is a big, thick book, you know, over 700 pages, and it's going to take me a while to work through it. But man, it's really, really good. You've heard me raving about it. It's one of these, it's like a David McCullough style biography where it's really long and you know, kind of going in, you're going to take some time with it. You're going to be living with it for a while, but I swear to you, every single page of this biography is interesting. And right now, you know, where I am is sort of mid-career for Douglass, and it's right smack in the middle of the Civil War. And there's just like news from the war every single day that he's reacting to, and because he manages and writes this paper. And there's it's fascinating because it kind of has me immersed right now in what it must have been like to be a citizen or an American as this war was going on and news would come in, you know, oh, the rebel army just entered into Maryland, or oh, General McClellan's forces just got destroyed, the Potomac. And it just really vividly brings forward to me again just how much was in the balance during those years for the entire country. And Frederick Douglass was right in the middle of all of it because he understood that the stakes could not possibly be higher for his people in the outcome of this war. And it was just, it's just like every day brings new, you know, storms that he has to wrangle with. And among the many fascinating things about it is how critical he was of the Lincoln administration. He was a severe critic of Abraham Lincoln through a lot of the Civil War. But then as things started to unfold and Lincoln, you know, grew closer to, you know, drafting the Emancipation Proclamation, you can feel it slowly turning. It's just fascinating. He was like to be sort of immersed in that time. And you kind of feel like you're almost on the ground in 1862 or 1863. It's just unbelievably interesting. So, and then Frederick Douglass had a long career after the Civil War, which I know almost nothing about. So that, including, you know, becoming an ambassador to Haiti. And it's just, so I know that there's much more ahead that's going to be interesting in this book. The book is work, but man, it's been richly rewarding for me. So I'll probably talk about that again sometime on this podcast. And I highly recommend it to anyone who finds that period of American history interesting or is interested at all in Frederick Douglass. So I'm still working my way through that. And I think that brings us to the end of all the preamble and the intro stuff that we do. And we're ready to dive into the discussion of Catch-22.
Yeah, let me just say really quick. First of all, I'm very glad that you're getting so much out of the book, even though it's so much work, because I know you, I'm sorry, I'm going to be a little crude here. I don't know why I'm saying this, but I know you kind of get off on learning. Well, you like learning. I shouldn't have said it that way, but anyway, that's
whatever.
In your mind. Sorry. You know, that's PG-13, but no, you like learning. And it's fun for me that you, every time you talk about it, you say you're learning something on every page. So that's, you know, that's big. That's a win. And then the only other thing I'm going to say, I'll keep it really short, is that I'm just so staggered by the biographer as a form of literary craft. You know, I feel like that's a whole different universe. So how much work goes into preparing to write a book like that, let alone on those big accomplished biographies, you know, writing it really clearly and well over how long it takes to write those books at that length and be true to the subject. Really staggeringly impressive to me. So cool on that, and we can roll on.
Yeah, the amount of research that went into this book is staggering to me. I don't even know the half of it, but the writer has written several other books about Frederick Douglass specifically. So this really kind of feels like a life work for him. Anyway, really, really good stuff. But let's start talking about Catch-22, this very famous war novel. As I said, came out in 1961. And I thought, you know, just to start, we'll talk a little bit about, you know, what we know about the background of the book and kind of how we, why did we decide to read it and or feature it in this episode? And it really boils down to this. You and I had, you know, we're book nerds and have been for decades. So, you know, we both know that the Modern Library, which is a major publisher of classics, you know, has this list of the 100 greatest novels of all time. And, you know, it's been out there. I think they put it out at the turn of the century, like around the year 2000. And I know for myself, like every once in a while, I might take a look at that list and be like, you know, I wonder if there's a book on this list that I haven't read that I really should, you know, that's just me. And you probably do the same thing, or maybe you have in the past. But anyway, we're both familiar with the list to some degree. And I don't remember how this came up, but, you know, just the idea that Catch-22 is number 7 on this list. So it's a top 10, and it's not top 10. It's not top 10 American novels of all time. It's not top 10 novels of the 20th century. It's in the top 10 of their all-time novels list, which is really staggering. And I think we were just talking about that, and we were both just like, you know, number one, as we said already, neither one of us have read it. And the other sort of surprising thing to us, and we talked about this a little bit, is that, like, we didn't feel like it's really being discussed all that much anymore, although it was hugely popular for a long time when it came out. And it all, basically what it boils down to is, why is this book number 7 on this list of all-time greatest novels? And I think we were both just really curious about that, wouldn't you say? I mean, that was sort of the impetus initially to, like, and also the fact that neither of us had, you know, even remotely picked it up. We were looking for a book to kind of read, and we said, you know what, it might be interesting to just, like, give this book a try and try to get into, like, why is this book as famous as it is? That's really how this all started, wouldn't you say?
Yes, yeah, for all those reasons. I mean, it's just something that had been around, swirling around in book discussion and book lore for as long as we've been alive. And I think I commented at one point when we were teasing this episode once or twice, maybe it was in a private conversation, but, like, how Joseph Heller, you know, he achieved, it took a while, as we might get into, but he achieved such fame and notoriety for a book like this that when we were growing up and forming our book sensibility, he was somebody you would hear about, you know, like every time he would come out with a new novel, right? It would be like, you know, an event because he's the guy that wrote Catch-22, and it was just part of the landscape, you know? And I think we did get to wondering, we were looking for something, you know, kind of to unpack that we were both ignorant of, you know? And we had talked at time to time about doing kind of a classic as for one of our BXC reviews, because we hadn't done a lot of that, you know? You know, then we started landing on this, and that, but I think you're right. I think it does boil down to, and I would even argue that I think it still boils down to, or It's still an open question. Why is this book rated as high as it is, or thought of as high as it is, now that we've both read it? I think I don't want to, you know, blow the shot early here, but, like, you know, I'm not sure that either one of us landed on, you know, this is instantly, obviously, should be in the top 10 books of all time. So, you know, that's very much still a relevant question, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I will say to you, even since we've last discussed it in preparation for this show, you know, and when we discussed it, we had both finally read it. My feelings about it have evolved a little bit. You know, I think like this is just the way I am, either with books or movies. Sometimes it takes a little bit of distance. You know, I'll see a movie like I haven't seen it yet, but let's say Oppenheimer or something, like a big kind of epic movie with a lot going on. It takes me a little bit of time to just kind of process it mentally and kind of really know how I feel about it. And you know this about me. And then usually like a week or two later, I'm coming in for a landing on what I really think. And this book is a little bit like that with me, you know, initially. Again, you know, not to jump ahead, but initially I had some, I struggled with the book. I will say that. But even since we've talked, Jude, a little more distance, like I feel like my appreciation for it as a novel and as a cultural event and as a work of art is growing. But that said, I still struggled with the actual reading, which we'll definitely get into. So, you know, is a novel about some men's experience during wartime. It's about pilots and bombardiers in World War II, and it's based, you know, very much on Joseph Heller's own experiences. He was a bombardier in World War II. In the novel, they are stationed on a fictional island off the coast of Italy, and they're involved in kind of the Italian campaign and sort of protecting Italy from the Germans, essentially. And it's kind of right smack in the middle of World War II. So, I don't know, 1941, 42, 43, somewhere in there. But interestingly enough, aside from some very vivid and fascinating passages that actually describe, you know, air combat, most of the book does not deal with combat itself. It deals with, you know, what it's like to be a soldier overseas, you know, deployed during a time of war. And, you know, the words that I'll just bring up now and that will come up again and again in this discussion, you know, are absurdity, farce. You know, it's very much, this is a madcap farce of a comedy with lots and lots of just ridiculous humor in it. And so,
Satire,
right. I mean, that's sort of the flavor of this novel, which, as you said, I didn't know that going in. You know, you're immediately struck in the first 5 to 10 pages by just, you know, there are parts of this book that are laugh out loud funny, and really the entire book is just as this, just an absurd tone. You know, it's just, you know, the situations that the soldiers either find themselves in or manufacture are just ridiculous. And it's especially, you know, kind of funny and skewering of, you know, the chain of command and that exists in the military. But, it could very much apply to, you know, a corporation or many other institutions. But so most of the novel has to do with these men who are stationed on this island in Italy and kind of what they're up to between missions. And one of the recurring themes in the book is that, you know, well, there's a main character named Yossarian who's basically just trying to get out of the war alive, essentially. And he, you know, there's this running theme where, you know, if you fly enough missions as a bombardier or as part of an air crew or as a pilot, you know, you can be done with your time over there and you can cycle back home. And all the soldiers involved in this novel, that's what they're trying to do. But they keep increasing the amount of missions that are required in order to, you know, cycle home. And that's a recurring thing throughout the book. Every time somebody gets close to, you know, going on leave, they raise the, you know, they raise the requirement of missions. So then this goes on and on and on through the whole book until, you know, spoiler alert, at, by the very, very end, you know, our hero, our main pilot is like, you know, screw it. You know, I'm just going to escape because this is never going to end. And that's kind of, that's sort of indicative of the way the whole book is. It's just, and this will be interesting for you, Drew, because you're someone who, even though you didn't deploy, you're someone who did serve in the military for a number of years. So as I was reading it, I thought, you know, this is really funny and absurd, but it must really resonate with somebody who has actually served or has, you know, been involved in the whole military machine, you know, in an even more powerful way than someone who hasn't. So I don't know. I'm jumping all over the place, but that's kind of what the book is about at a very, very broad level. Is there anything else that you'd want to add about, you know, what this book deals with?
Well, first of all, let me just say to you, I almost don't want to say this, but I just want to warn you, like, that. So for me, on my end, the audio has been cutting out every once in a while for 4 or 5 seconds. It's happened 3 times, but it comes back in. So I just want to say to you, like, if you toss to me and I don't answer, just give it a couple seconds. We'll just keep going as we've always done. So, because I've heard just about everything, just
well, a couple hiccups. And we could stop and just, you know, reconnect really quick too.
Yeah, let's just keep going for now. We might take a break a little bit later. But
okay. Anyway. I'll say to you too, like, your voice is getting quieter. So I don't know if it's a matter of holding the phone closer to your mouth or what, but pretty quiet.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll keep trying. It's just some of the audio hiccups that we have from time to time. But anyway, yeah, I mean, I think your sort of intro and your lead up to all this, even though it was kind of zigzagging here and there, is all pretty well accurate. I mean, you know, to touch on your last point, it is kind of interesting to reading this to see, and then, you know, I never served in combat and I was only in for 4 years and it was a long time ago, but it's interesting to observe some of the things that don't change for sure about the military culture. One of those is like kind of a sense of absurdity in either training or in warfare, I would imagine, because you always have this sense that just like, you know, hurry up and wait and all those things that soldiers say, there's always kind of like a kind of rampant absurdity behind all of it. And then, you know, it's just kind of interesting to see, and certainly things like the banter between troops and the smack talk and trying to figure out what to do when there's nothing to do and stuff like the mess hall and all that stuff kind of rings true to anybody who's ever served, I think. But you're right. Like, I was just going to point out, like, you know, the overall tone of the book that's just so interesting is kind of like one of absurdity, like as you were saying. And that absurdity kind of just almost resounds on every page of the novel. And I actually found one sentence. I mean, you can probably find many, many sentences in this book, John, that kind of encapsulate the tone. But I found one dead right. I'm just going to read it dead right in the middle of the book, page 288. It's like kind of a 450-page book or something like that. And the sentence reads, you don't need any context. It says, Arfie is a name. Arfie was a lead navigator who had never been able to find himself since leaving college. That in one sentence encapsulates the tone of the entire novel, I think. You know, there's like, you know, there's a lot of like just irony and like, you know, things kind of doubling back on themselves, even within sentences and within moments in the book.
No, that's great because it's indicative of the wit and humor that's in the book. You know, not just like, some of it's broad, but some of it is very subtle, and some of it is both in the same sentence, like you just read. I mean, while we're reading, I had a passage that I was going to read, but I'll jam it in now, if you don't mind. Can you still hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
And I just highlighted this because I thought it's also indicative of the type of humor in this book, but I thought you would have been howling at this brief passage I'm going to read. Which is just sort of about, again, you don't really need the context, but it's a general talking to, you know, somebody underneath him in the chain of command. And I just, it's really funny, but I thought, dude, you know, for anybody who served in the military, this is indicative of the tone of the book, but also like the kind of satire there is. I just thought this was hilarious. And it goes like this. Well, I guess, you know, Colonel Scheisskopf has been given an assignment to write something. And he goes, I don't know anything about writing, Colonel Shishkov retorted. And the general says, well, don't let that trouble you, General Peckham continued with a careless flick of his wrist. Just pass the work I assign you along to somebody else and trust to luck. We call that delegation of responsibility. Somewhere down near the lowest level of this coordinated organization I run are people who do get the work done when it reaches them, and everything manages to run along smoothly without too much effort on my part. I suppose that's because I'm a good executive. Nothing we do in this large department of ours is really very important, and there's never any rush. On the other hand, it is important that we let people know we do a great deal of it. Let me know if you find yourself shorthanded. I've already put in a requisition for 2 majors, 4 captains, and 16 lieutenants to give you a hand. While none of the work we do is very important, it is important that we do a great deal of it. Don't you agree? And I thought, it's just so ridiculous. You know, I thought, Anybody who served in the military has got to read that paragraph and just howl.
Yeah. And that's all over the book. So, like, if a reader doesn't have a taste for that kind of humor, you know, this book isn't going to light you up because it's just one absurdity after another. But the other thing to point out, John, is that I think it's certainly not true. It can't be true that this was, like, the first kind of absurdist or comic novel having to do with combat or war, you know. But this was a novel about the Second World War that was coming out, like, sort of within 20 years after the war ended. And before it came out, most of the canonical works or the best-known works about World War II were things of the stripe of, like, The Thin Red Line by James Jones, or From Here to Eternity, or The Naked and the Dead by Norman Mailer.
Right.
Something like Battle Cry, John, a book you and I know, by Leon Uris.
Right.
I'm saying that correctly. They were long, realistic novels about the horrors of war. And what Joseph Heller did, and it almost certainly wasn't the first one to do it, but he just wrote this zany, sort of madcap, absolutely absurdist comedy about the horrors of that particular war. And that's one of the things that I think must have made this book seem so fresh and really at first kind of baffled people, you know? Like, it took a while for it to really catch on.
Yeah, and I think that's one reason why, and you and I have both read some stuff about the book since we read the novel. I think that's one reason why this book did well initially, but it really took off as the Vietnam War was escalating. And I think I read somewhere, you know, somebody said as the kind of, you know, the moral implications of the war effort were really catching fire, you know, with the conscience of the American public, not just American, but people all around the world. You know, there was a new appreciation for Joseph Heller's book. In fact, you know, as we read in one, I think the introduction to this version, you know, many soldiers who served in Vietnam, you know, were reading this book. And there's a guy who became a U.S. Senator named James Webb. Right, James Webb?
Yeah, also was a novelist himself.
Right, a novelist himself has written about, you know, reading Catch 22, like, literally during combat while he was serving in Vietnam. So, and we ourselves, as we might touch on later, you know, we have a family member, an uncle of ours, who served over in Vietnam as well. And he's listed this as one of his favorite books. So, you know, even Joseph Heller acknowledged that. And he says in a little piece that he wrote about creating Catch 22, he says, you know, this book coming out just as the Vietnam War was escalating was a lucky thing. And then he says, it was lucky for me. It wasn't lucky for anybody who was involved in the Vietnam War, you know. So he acknowledged that himself.
Yeah. Like, I think, John, this aspect of it is really one of the most interesting things about the book to me. Like, when I was kind of stepping away from the book and trying to assess what I thought of it, I was like, well, one of the things that held me the most wrapped wasn't even so much the book itself, but it was about the way, I guess I was trying to find a way into the understand my under my own understanding of why it was so huge and is still so huge. And the timing of it, when you hear people talk about something in the popular culture catching on to like the zeitgeist or whatever, this is like kind of almost exhibit A.
Yeah.
You know? And it, the thing is, like, it's not just the Vietnam War. I don't have to, I mean, you know this, but I don't have to point this out at great length, but so, cause like the book really caught on. It was published in 1961, as you pointed out, and it caught on like a little while after that. So if it was catching fire with the whole situation of the war, it was doing so at the very beginning of that. But it was also just a matter of being catching on to the zeitgeist of the 1960s in general. You know,
right.
Like it's hard to separate the Vietnam War from the 1960s, but the 1960s, as we all know, is this tumultuous period in American history. You know, you had the assassination of Kennedy early on. And it was all that when Vietnam was just getting started. So it like really caught, you know, a hold of a couple different waves of things and then had this way of kind of, it didn't just get caught up in that. It kind of like blew it open sort of, you know? And then, so it's not just a matter of like the author Joseph Heller and like the book getting sort of lucky, quote unquote, but because of the context that it came out in, it sort of demonstrated how brilliant the book was in the first place, you know?
Yeah. And I think people like us, like in our generation, maybe generations after us, you know, we've sort of been conditioned or trained almost to think of World War II as like this almost holy war. You know, like things like Tom Brokaw's The Greatest Generation, things like
right.
Steven Spielberg's Saving Private Ryan, many, many other examples in popular culture that people like you and I, and again, you know, people even younger than us, that has fed into our perception of what, you know, of the war. And so, but Joseph Heller writing this kind of a satirical, it's satirical, by the way, but it also, in places, it gets very dark and biting, and it bites hard in many places. And so in some ways, it feels like a prophetic book because you almost expect, again, people of our generation younger, you know, you almost everything you hear about the Vietnam War and that conflict is negative, you know, and whereas World War II is sort of bathed in this like holy light of being this righteous and just war. And, you know, one that America, quote unquote, won, et cetera. And a lot of that is true. But, you know, for Joseph Heller to write this flavor of a book, but have it come out of World War II, to readers now, you kind of read that and it feels almost sort of prophetic, you know, which is another one of many interesting aspects of this whole book. But let's just really quick, I do want to just say a little bit more about, you know, the experience of the book and kind of like the way it's written. First of all, we've mentioned several times, this is a thick book. It's 450 pages or so, but it's very dense. And it's written in a series of all the chapters, almost all the chapters or the majority of the chapters are just named for a different character. So there's a huge cast of characters in this book that he's sort of juggling. And the chapters are very, I'm not going to say episodic because that implies that one follows after the other, but it's just almost these vignettes. Some of them are absurd. Some of them, as I said, could be very dark. Like there's a character named Snowden who was killed during one of the bombing runs. And he's mentioned again and again in the book. And then late in the book, there's a chapter that describes, you know, how he was killed and what that experience was like. And he died in the arms of the main character, Yossarian. And that chapter is very, very brutal. So it's like most of the chapters are sort of absurd and funny, but not all for sure. And I want to emphasize that because this book is very funny, but it also gets very dark and visceral at times. But, you know, there's just these short chapters that, you know, most of them are named for soldiers. Some are named for, there's one named for the chaplain, who's an important character. There are some that are named for, you know, prostitutes that are in Rome that they go to visit. There's even a chapter for this mysterious soldier in white, who's just an injured soldier in the hospital, and he's completely covered from head to toe with bandages and plaster, and nobody knows who he is, you know, and you never know who he is or what happened to him, but there's a whole chapter sort of dedicated to him. So it's just kind of like mosaic almost. And the other thing I wanted to say about it that I thought was really interesting that, you know, I guess it's been discussed widely, but, you know, I haven't heard it, is that this book has has a very interesting structure because it jumps around in time, and you don't, like, for example, the first chapter is like sort of chronologically right in the middle of things, but you don't know it when you're reading it. And so each chapter kind of jumps backward or forward in time, and you're kind of, the reader is sort of left to, you know, kind of piece it together in their own mind. And I thought, you know, just, this is a side note, Jude, but I thought, you know, Quentin Tarantino got so much credit for like jumbling up the timeline in his movie Pulp Fiction. Do you remember the huge, everybody just went crazy, like that had never been done before? You know, yeah. Catch 22, it's the same thing. You know, the time is, you know, you start in the middle and it goes back and forward. And I was just kind of laughing to myself about that because I was like, oh, well, that really wasn't as an original idea as maybe people thought. I mean, back in 1961 here, Joseph Heller's novel works the same way. And you have to, just like in Pulp Fiction, you have to kind of work a little bit to sort of figure out the chronology, which, you know, some people may find frustrating, but others may find, you know, an engaging puzzle. So those are just a few comments about, you know, what the book is like and how it's structured, etc.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's a good point about Catch 22 and Pulp Fiction and other works that, I mean, there are so many works across different medium that you can, that you read this book. That's one of the things about it too. And you see, well, now I know why we have this or that, everything from something like Pulp Fiction to, you know, more recent war books that couldn't possibly have existed without Catch 22. Even to somebody like, remember the character Kenny from South Park?
Sure.
The guy who has, it's like buttoned up and you can't hear anything he says. He's kind of a direct descendant of that guy in white in Catch 22 in a way, just like to sort of a character that's there that never really says anything, but hangs on for 18 seasons or whatever it is, you know,
I didn't think of that, but that's true.
Yeah. I mean, you just find so many pieces of this book that have trickled down into the culture. You know, although it's the genius that, you know, you do have to give somebody like Quentin Tarantino credit for doing what all artists do, which is to step on the shoulders of artists, but making it seem like he came up with something brand new, you know?
That's right.
But anyway.
Yeah.
But I want to go back and just say, I kind of feel like we should do this. I actually dog-eared John, if you don't mind me reading here, because like the, when it comes down to the very name of the book, Catch 22, and we were talking about kind of what that phrase means and stuff, there's this one salient paragraph that kind of explains it, which I was just going to read just in case anybody listening to this doesn't quite have a hold of what Catch 22 means. Is that okay?
Yeah, that's a great idea.
Yeah, it's right at the beginning of the book. It's not at the very beginning, but there's one salient paragraph that explains it and also is reinforcing the point we're making about the absurdity of the whole story. And it just says, I'll just read it really quick. There was only one catch, and that was Catch 22, which specified that a concern for one's own safety in the face of dangers that were real and immediate was the process of a rational mind. This is speaking to Yossarian trying to get out of doing combat missions because he was claimed he was crazy. So was the process of a rational mind, or another character was crazy and could be grounded. All he had to do was ask. But as soon as he did, he would no longer be crazy and would have to fly more missions. Or would be crazy to fly more missions and sane if he did not. But if he was sane, he had to fly them. And if he flew them, he was crazy and didn't have to. But if he didn't want to, he was sane and he had to. Yossarian was moved very deeply by the absolute simplicity of this clause of Catch 22. He let out a respectful whistle, like, you know, So that speaks to the absurdity of the book. But then, John, you pointed out there are moments, especially toward the end, when it gets so dark. And I'm going to read again, but it's just kind of one or two sentences. And I'm sorry for the spoiler, but we've already said, like, there's one character that gets killed. And this book can zag all the way to things like this. You know, Yossarian is holding this guy Snowden, who's been kind of eviscerated by flak that has come into the airplane. And it says he felt goose pimples clacking all over him. This is very late in the book. As he gazed down despondently at the grim secret that Snowden had spilled all over the messy floor, it was easy to read the message in his entrails. Man was matter. That was Snowden's secret. So that's very dark and very profound. Man was matter. And again, it speaks to kind of what's really going on behind this whole book. You know, like with the rampant absurdity in there, but there's this whole, as you pointed out, really dark undercurrent kind of brewing all along about all this absurdity and the fact that it kind of resulted, it was all part of war, which results in like sort of like mass death, you know?
Yeah, that's both of what you read there. Those are both great passages to read to give, you know, folks just an idea of that iconic phrase, Catch-22, and also, you know, some of the depths that this book will go to. That's that passage, I earmarked it too in the very late part of the book where, you know, we find out actually what happens to Snowden. And again, Snowden is referred to throughout the whole novel. And it's important to say that, you know, I said about the main character, Yossarian, he literally spends the entire book just trying to get out of, it seems like trying to get out of duty, you know, and just like escape. But you kind of realize too, as you read through the book, like you just said, like you just referenced, some of what he's been through, you know, that brought him to this state, and, you know, some of the mistakes he's made and, you know, some of the missions he's flown and some of the things that have happened, you realize that, you know, he has every reason to want to be done with this war, and he's been through quite a lot and he's seen quite a lot of trauma, you know, in and around him. And so even though he's an absurd character and he deals with so many absurdities, there is, and I was going to mention this before, but there is, you know, this book is very funny, but you do discern as you read through it, especially by the time you get to the end. I'm hearing a little bit of an echo here, but whatever. There's nothing we can do about this stuff with this app. But you know, as you go, you discern that the book is getting darker. And I would say it ends on a pretty dark note, even though there's a, you know, it seems like Yossarian may be escaping, you know, from his deployment. But you do detect kind of a dark arc to this entire book. It's certainly not all comedy, nor is it meant to be.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think there are other dark elements to this book, too. Maybe that weren't even, like, intended to be dark. Like, one thing that I was really struck kind of hard by, which is more a product of kind of, I don't know, sort of where we've progress to in our society now, as opposed to reading it 60 or 70 years ago. Like, for example, the treatment of women in this book is very, I thought it was kind of troubling, you know, like it's not very surprising, you know, given, you know, kind of when it was written and, you know, the context of, you know, our societal mores or whatever you want to say. But it was still like, it still struck me. I mean, you know, I can sort of tolerate a lot of that. Maybe it's just because I'm like a white guy or whatever, but I like, there's a lot of that stuff that won't trouble me as much. I did find it troubling in this book, you know, the fact that there were so many prostitutes and they were just kind of liberally tossed around from man to man, and just kind of the way that they were treated in this book in general. It's perhaps not the most salient point of the discussion of Catch-22, but I was still, that to me was another really dark element of it. And I, you know, sort of, Trying to imagine, you know, a female reader taking this book on and what she would think of it in this day and age, you know?
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely worth noting. And also, like, there's at least one character who's really young, like 12 or 13, something like frighteningly young, who's kind of the sister of one of these prostitutes, but is clearly being, like, brought into this whole system. And the other thing is too, like in the novel, even the female characters just go along with it. Like they hardly express any kind of like, I'm sure they're not happy with it, but they just kind of accept it, which is a little troubling in and of itself. But all the female characters, they all feel like just playthings for the soldiers, like whether they're prostitutes or the nurses, like there's tons of, as you would expect, but there's tons of flirtation. Mm-hmm. I agree. That stuff is pretty troubling, and I can't imagine being a female reader and, I don't know. I think it would be very difficult for a female reader to find a lot that they liked about this book, frankly. Which sort of...
Yeah, like one of... Pardon me.
No, go ahead. I was going to say that sort of segues us into, talking about our own kind of impressions of the book, but what were you going to say?
Yeah, and we can. I just have one friend who's a very intelligent woman in the legal profession. And she saw I commented on the book that I was reading it in social media, and she was like, I started it, but then I put it down again. There's so many great books, and I just didn't have time for this one. And I couldn't, I didn't really blame her. It didn't seem like the kind of book that would interest somebody like her, and I can't blame her. So,
yeah,
it depends on the beholder with a novel like this.
Yeah, agreed. And, sometimes, a lot of times with older classics, you go back to them now as somebody reading in 2023 and you can find lots of problems with them. They're just like, dated in some ways or, culturally or sociologically or whatever. And that's part of what you have to grapple with, as you look at it. And that's part of what we want to grapple with was like, how do we view this book as readers in 2023 and whether it, deserves its reputation, which is something we can pick up with. I suggest we take a quick break here and then we'll come back and we've been dancing around it, but sort of, now that we've read the entire novel, just kind of like, what do we really think of it, and whether or not it deserves quite the amount of praise that it's gotten.
Yeah. Okay. That sounds good.
All right. Okay, so Jude, if you can still hear me, we've talked a lot about the book and kind of, some of the background, and we've shared some impressions, but this is the part of the program where we kind of give our overall impressions. So again, I set this up this way. Let's not forget that this book by the esteemed people at Modern Library, which who knows, who was involved creating that list. But they have this book in the top 10 of all-time novels. So that means it's next to books like Ulysses, The Sound and the Fury, Portrait of an Artist as a Young Man, Lolita. I mean, this is the company, The Grapes of Wrath. This is the company that this novel finds itself in terms of this list anyway. Now that you've had some distance, you've read the whole book, now that you've had some distance from it, this is the big question, I guess. I'm glad you're taking this on first. But, what is your overall evaluation, and do you feel it belongs in that esteemed company? And also, sorry. Just as you get started, I step all over you. And also, talk a little bit about your experience with the book overall, because as I've mentioned, I struggled during the actual reading of it, I think a little bit more than you did.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's a little easier for me. As far as, does it deserve to be in the top 10? I mean, I'll say that it wouldn't be in my top 10.
Yeah.
I think it's earned a very high place in the canon, especially from this country, because I think it is kind of a brilliant satire, but satire and, focusing on the hilariously insane aspects of war, that by itself is not going to appeal to a lot of people,
True. That's a good point.
I think it deserves a very high ranking. Now, in terms of my experience, it's interesting. You pointed out before that, you know, because when we first both finished it, we were exchanging notes really quick, and you said, you know, I got tired of it. I didn't like it as much. And I thought, well, I enjoyed it a little more than John did. And then you pointed out that as you gain more distance from it, your esteem for it is growing. I know you weren't saying this, but everybody does that, right? Like, you know, you gain a little distance from something like this, and your evaluation continues in your mind, and it may change. But as a way of answering the question with my experience, John, I got helped out because the edition of it I read, you can still hear me, right?
Yes.
Okay. Was the 50th anniversary edition. I believe you had the same edition.
I do.
And there, at the back of the book, there was like almost 100 pages worth of a section called Other Voices. And it had a bunch of critical works, basically. Some reviews that were contemporary to publication and other critical works as time went on over those 50 years. Now, I found one, which is an excerpt from a book that was written by Norman Mailer. He was a very famous novelist of the 20th century, and he wrote that book, The Naked and the Dead, which was one of those realistic, canonical works about World War II. I'm going to read a short passage from something he said, because this not only describes kind of what my initial reaction to the book was, but it also touches on what your initial reaction to the book was. And I fall down somewhere in this camp with what Norman Mailer is saying here. So I'm reading from him. There's no book like it anyone has read, yet it's maddening. It reminds one of a Jackson Pollock painting, 8 feet high, 20 feet long, like yard goods. One could cut it anywhere. One could take out 100 pages from the middle of Catch-22, and not even the author would be certain that they were gone. Yet the length and the similarity of one page to another gives a curious meat and potatoes to the madness. That's where I fell down. I was cognizant, because you said when you first read it, you got, I believe you told me, and I know you're reevaluating, I'm not saying this is like some kind of jab, but you told me that, like, you know, after you read 120 pages, when you kept reading, you felt like you were reading the same thing. I had a little bit of a sense of that's part of the point of what's going on here as I was reading it. I'm not saying I reacted better. That's just kind of what I felt. And I think part of it was also I found the style of this book very readable. And the other point I wanted to make was that it's a comic book. It's a comedic book. But I wondered if it was still going to be a funny book to someone reading it now as opposed to 60, 70 years ago. I found it very funny. I found it very readable. And I had the sense, and I'll turn it over to you, that the repetitiveness of it, because other reviews in the back of the book point out as a liability that the book is repetitive, I had the sense, and maybe this does speak to my military experience, John, I don't know, that was part of the method on purpose. Because you just sort of sit there doing the same shit over and over again, waiting for something to happen. So that was like I caught on to that quickly. I'm not saying that in a, you know what I'm saying. I'm not saying that in an intellectually fleet way, because I'm one of the slowest readers in the world. Like, I miss everything. But I saw that as part of the method. So I'll turn it over to you. Like, I know a little bit about your reaction, but describe your experience.
Well, first of all, crap. There's that echo again. First of all, when you say you're the slowest reader in the world and you miss everything, I'm sorry, but there are 56 previous episodes of this podcast that will testify differently. You know, like, you definitely pick up on a lot when you read, but that, you know, I get what you're saying. You're using some hyperbole there, but
yeah.
I do get it, as I said to you, as I said to our uncle when we were discussing with him, and like I said previously, this is one of his favorite books, and, you know, he has the additional experience of having served in Vietnam, and so he brings other perspectives to the table that I don't. But I said to both of you, are you hearing me okay?
Yes.
Okay. I said to both of you, like, I understand that, like, the repetitive nature is part of the style and part of the point. But at the same time, I still had to chuckle because there is a, in one of these, I only read a couple of the supplementary materials at the back. I think you read them all. But one of the famous parts of this book's history is that it was edited by Robert Gottlieb, who's that's a name that you may recognize, Jude. Yes. He's a legendary editor who has edited many, many American classics, as well as he had, and I think still has, if I'm not mistaken, this lifelong working relationship with the author Robert Caro, who you've talked about before.
Yes.
Are you aware that there's a documentary about their relationship, Bob Gottlieb and Robert Caro?
Yes, I am. I believe Gottlieb died recently, though.
Okay. Yeah, I wasn't sure because I think they're both in their late 80s or something. But anyway, as far as like book editors go, he's like, you know, the Tom Brady of book editors, or Babe Ruth or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, and so he sort of famously championed this book from the beginning, and he became the editor of it. And he makes a comment somewhere that I read recently where he said that he convinced Joseph Heller to cut out several passages or chapters of the book because he thought they were discursive and they were taking away from the main narrative. So Joseph Heller agreed. And I'm sorry, but I had to chuckle when I heard that. And I was like, you know, first of all, I was just laughing. Like, can you imagine if those chapters were still in the book? Because the book felt so long to me. And secondly, it's like if those chapters were judged discursive, I feel like there's so many other chapters that are in the book that are discursive. And they're just like, you know, they take him off into Rome for a chapter, or he go, you know, one might be a flashback about this time and somebody's, you know. Like, it just made me laugh because I thought, well, what was deemed discursive and what wasn't? Because I felt so much of the book was discursive, and yet repetitive. And that sounds a lot harsher than I really felt. But I'm not going to lie. Like, I did feel, and for better or for worse, and maybe I'm a less intelligent reader than, you know, many, many other people when it comes to this book. But I felt like the point you were making about the repetitiveness of it and, you know, the absurdity of it, and you're caught in this endless cycle, I felt like I got all of that after, you know, 200 pages, 300 pages or whatever. And most of the book was more of the same of that. And it just, it's kind of, that's sort of a subjective thing, kind of just like, what is your tolerance for that? If you can get into the rhythm of it and you find it funny, which I did too, and you just don't mind hanging out with these characters, and maybe you won't mind as much. And that may be part of the appeal of the book for some, but, and I enjoyed that for a good long while, but I just then felt like I got to about page 250 or 300. And I was sort of like, yeah, you know, I got it. I just wondered, okay, I get what we're doing here, but are we moving towards any kind of a climax, or is it just going to be more of the same? And I don't know, maybe that's just the kind of reader that I am. I know that there have been many books. I mean, your love of Dickens, for example, Jude, like some of these books, those books are just like two telephone books tied together, like Bleak House or something. And you just don't mind because you just enjoy being with those characters and you enjoy just being in that world. And, you know, there's some readers that are like that. Whereas, you know, maybe I'm less like that. But then again, you know, my favorite novel ever is Moby Dick, you know, which is a really long, discursive book about hunting after a whale. And as most people know, you know, they finally get to the whale in the last like 40 pages, you know. So
right.
I don't know. I'm contradicting myself, but there's a different tone, very different tone to Moby Dick that's more like almost metaphysical and almost spiritual and kind of exploring, you know, really deep mysteries that is not the tone of Catch-22. I mean, not to say that it doesn't touch on any of those questions, but it's much more madcap, farcical, you know, just kind of episodic and kind of the absurdity of men in battle, you know?
Well,
I don't know. I'm rambling here, you know, I would say overall, as I said to you, before we recorded, like, my appreciation for this book is growing, but appreciation and enjoyment, you know, sometimes are two different things. And I did struggle with the length of the book.
Well, there's a couple things I want to comment on there, if I can. If you think that we've covered kind of our initial experience of the book.
Please.
Okay, so the first thing I want to say is, I want to give you a little compliment because you make a very good point about what I said to start off talking about my experience of the book, which is, and I think this is very salient, just because part of the method is to keep repeating things and, you know, show the madness through the repetitive nature of it. Just because that is true does not necessarily translate into literary merit, does it? Depends on the reader. And it does not necessarily mean that you're going to like it, even if you've caught on to that method.
Right.
You can say to yourself, oh, I see this is the method. I still don't like it. So I think you make a very salient point there. You know, even though your evaluation of the book is evolving. But I want to transition to another point because you brought up something there about the book. You know, you brought up Moby Dick, which is interesting too, because I don't know if you know this, but our little sister has been reading Moby Dick and she's been interacting with me, just a little side note. And she got to the end and I think she really, it kind of blew her away, which I was hoping.
Yeah.
So I think she really loved the book and I've been thinking about Moby Dick. In fact, I'm watching a miniseries right now. Different topic. But when you say that Moby Dick is much more philosophical, metaphysical, even spiritual, I agree with all of that. But there is an aspect to this book, and you didn't say there wasn't, that does go farther. And there was, I think this is the last time we'll do this, but there's a passage that I dog-eared that brings that up. I want to read it. I want to just kind of say something about it.
I'm glad you're bringing in some passages from the book because I think that really, you know, gives readers a true flavor. I like it when we can do that. I'm just not always prepared to do it, so I'm glad you're a little more prepared.
I'm almost never prepared, but somehow I got there this time with passages I'm talking about. But anyway, because you're right. I think you're generally right. You know, it has this madcap, zany tone. It doesn't seem to go that further out, expand outward so much when you're first reading it from just the madness and insanity of war and all it curtails. But I would argue this book does go farther. And then there's a passage, again, this is dead in the middle of the book, page 268. I just bring that up because there's like 450 pages, something like that. And it's a chapter about the chaplain, so this makes sense. But it reads like this. Doubts of such kind gnawed at the chaplain's lean, suffering frame insatiably. Was there a single true faith or life after death? How many angels could dance on the head of a pin? And with what matters did God occupy himself in all the infinite eons before the creation? Why was it necessary to put a protective seal in the brow of Cain if there were no other people to protect him from? Did Adam and Eve produce daughters? These were the great complex questions of my ontology that tormented him, yet they never seemed nearly as crucial to him as the question of kindness and good manners. So those elements of the book are in here, and what I'll do is this, John. I'll turn it into a question. I thought, and then some of the pieces that I read at the end kind of expanded on this. I thought, and maybe it's obvious, but that this book was kind of an essential satire on the insanity of war and all that has to do with it. But it goes beyond even that, doesn't it? Like, I thought it sort of expanded out in many ways into almost the whole concept of our country, you know, and skewering like America itself, capitalism. There's that one whole character we haven't mentioned, Minderbinder.
Yeah.
Whose entire orchestration of the war is to turn into a business syndicate, like a business transaction.
Right.
So that everything that's involved just makes him money to the point where he pays the enemy to bomb their airfield. You know, because the point is making money. And I thought it, my question has to do with what's your take on this? I thought it did expand out as the book went on and also as the book lived on in my mind. It's more than just satirizing war. It's satirizing America. It's satirizing capitalism. And you can even say that it's satirizing like the human condition, so to speak, that we're sort of greedy people, etc. You know, I'm sure you're a smart reader. I'm sure you caught a lot of that. Did that add anything to your assessment of the book or your enjoyment of the book, the fact that it went out farther?
Yeah, and I think, gosh, this echo distracts me. I hope listeners aren't hearing that, but
I hope not.
Sorry. Yeah, and I think that's part of what how my appreciation of the book has grown since I've read it. Like, you just kind of realize, I agree with you 100%, that this book is about more than just, it's more than just, like I said earlier, life during wartime. You know, is definitely making comments on just sort of the way America works. There's even some allusions to the fact that some of the soldiers, you know, have fathers that were like very wealthy or successful in business. And there's, you know, brief allusions here and there to kind of like, you know, the sons kind of living with that sort of pressure. You know, I mentioned Gottlieb in cutting out certain chapters. There was one chapter that he cut out that was all about, it was a discussion between one of the characters and his father, who was like a big businessman. It was sort of like a critique of capitalism, you know, kind of more overtly. So you're right. Those elements are definitely.
Also, not to interrupt you, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but there was also that one character, the doctor, whose whole gripe with being at war was not the threat to his own body and not death and destruction, et cetera, but it was the fact that he had a lucrative business going and that he had to stop it in order to serve his country and he could be making money hand over fist.
Absolutely. You
know? Yep. So that's another one, but go ahead.
Well, you're proving yourself wrong before about what you miss when you read, because that's a great point and a great thing to pull out, because that's a perfect example of what we're talking about. And that's, of course, that's not by accident. So I think that all goes into what we're talking about, which is not just our own personal impressions of the book over time, but overall impressions and evaluations of the book over time. I mean, that this kind of stuff is why the book, I presumably, is placed so high on that list and why it has the reputation that it has and why it's endured. So, you know, I think that's one other thing we were talking about, like, for example, what woman would enjoy this book, you know, given kind of the attitudes and towards women and the sort of blatant misogyny that's in it. But if you can kind of step back from that a little bit and look at what the book is saying about America and about, you know, these larger questions, then there may be some value there, despite, you know, some of those passages.
Yeah, good point.
Joseph Heller, there's a piece from Joseph Heller called Reeling in Catch 22, where he describes, you know, the writing of the book. And it's a brief piece, but just to kind of underline what you're saying, and this hits on a couple points we made earlier, but then towards the end of this brief passage, he talks about what you just brought up. You know, he says, Catch-22 came to the attention of college students at about the same time that the moral corruption of the Vietnam War became evident. The treatment of the military as corrupt, ridiculous, and asinine could be applied literally to that war. Vietnam was a lucky coincidence. Lucky for me, not for the people. Between the mid and late 60s, the paperback of Catch-22 went from 12 printings to close to 30, which is amazing. And then he says, there was a change in spirit, a new spirit of healthy irreverence. There was a general feeling that the platitudes of Americanism were horseshit. Number one, they didn't work. Number two, they weren't true. Number three, the people giving voice to them didn't believe them either. You know? So,
yeah.
Like, so that's Joseph Heller speaking to what you're talking about. Like, that the book, you realize that, and again, like all things with me, like I have to step back from it to kind of realize the broader implications of a piece of a work of art sometimes. But you realize that what this book has in its scope or what it's taking aim at is broader than just one soldier's experience as an airman during World War II. It's broader than World War II itself. And, you know, and this is, by the way, I mean, maybe this is a way to segue a little bit to one thing I want to touch on before we're done, which is sort of how Catch-22 stacks up against other great works set during wartime. But what we're talking about is the same, is related to why a book like, for example, All Quiet on the Western Front, which was recently adapted, you know, into a searing movie on Netflix. And by the way, we haven't mentioned yet that Catch-22 was recently adapted by George Clooney and his team for a series on Hulu, which is interesting. Just an interesting side note. But
yes,
All Quiet on the Western Front or The Red Badge of Courage, which is set during the Civil War. Why have these books last as long as they have? Because certainly in the case of All Quiet on the Western Front, while not being a farce, while not being a madcap comedy in any way, you know, it makes a comment on, you know, the absurdity of war in general and kind of like the moral corruption of mankind and almost on like this idea of not capitalism per se, but like just war being this like efficient machine that just churns through men. You know, remember the beginning of the film adaptation of All Quiet on the Western Front, where you see this one soldier die and you watch his uniform get recycled and just put on another body. You know, it's just kind of like this whole machine, you know, it's making a comment on things that are broader than just that particular war. And that's why the book has lasted. That's why the book still appeals, because of these universal themes. And it's the same thing with Catch-22. Catch-22 has that in common with a book like All Quiet on the Western Front or The Red Badge of Courage, even though the tone is very different. You know what I'm trying to say?
Yeah. No, I do.
So I don't know if you had anything else you wanted to share about your impressions of Catch-22, but I did think it might be a good way to end this discussion and just saying, like, what are some other books that came to mind for you? You and I talked about this a little bit when we were prepping for this show, but what are some other books that are, you know, either comparisons or touch points that may have come to mind when you were reading this one, either as a contrast or as something that you felt like might belong in the same category as Catch-22? Because I have a few that I could bring up, but are there other books that you thought of when you were reading it?
I think there are some that I thought of that I've since forgotten. Maybe you will, maybe you will cover some of them. But I can think of a couple. You know, you and I were joking offline that the book that I think this is kind of a, no, it's not really contemporary. It came slightly after, but the authors were contemporaries. One book that I think of is the book Gravity's Rainbow by Thomas Pynchon, but I've already said in here, and I think the episode called The Intimidators, that I read that entire book and I didn't understand a single word of it. So I'm not necessarily the authority, but I know it was this massive tome about wartime in Europe that was satirical because Thomas Pynchon, the author of that book, and also The Crying of Lot 49 and V and stuff like that, he was just getting his sea legs when Joseph Heller was getting his sea legs, although Gravity's Rainbow came out a decade later. But I know it was this huge, absurd war book that had to do with, you know, stealing the plans for, like, the V-2 rocket from the Germans or something like that. You know, it's this big, sprawling satire about war. So that book comes to my mind. Also, there's a much more obscure book, but I thought about this a lot reading and you're familiar with it because I've kind of forced it on you. But I brought up many times in this podcast this novelist that I work with at the New School named Stephen Wright, who was a veteran of the Vietnam War. And his first novel was also a satire about Vietnam. It was called Meditations in Green. I actually found a lot of salient connections between. I don't think that book would have existed without Catch-22. And, of course, he also had the experience to feed into it. But there's many rampant absurdities in that novel. It's a lesser-known novel, but it also happens to be a war novel in which not much combat happens because it's about intelligence soldiers.
Yeah.
So it's just really about kind of the crazy machine and not so much about the horrors of war, although there are scenes in which the horrors of war are brought out vividly in that novel. But there's also a whole, there's one character who's trying to make a film, like a war movie, during war, so he can cash in on the war movie. And he's trying to, like, shoot his climactic sequence during a huge battle. You know, it's just ridiculous.
Yeah.
But so I thought about that book a lot. But then I also thought about other writers. Like, for example, we did a whole episode on the great American fiction writer, T.C. Boyle, John, in one of our Dealer's Choice episodes where we drilled down on one writer. And he was a great champion of the absurd. Like, he grew up on, like, absurdist playwrights from the 1950s. And a lot of his work is really kind of zany and crazy. Totally different. Not really war-based, but I think a book like Catch-22 must have been extremely influential on somebody like him.
Yeah.
And then lastly, and then I'll turn it over to you, there is a big sprawling, again, not as well-known, but it made a big splash at the time about 10 or 15 years ago. There was a novel that came out about the Iraq War that was definitely a child of Catch-22. It's called Fobbit by a guy named David Abrams. Fobbit was an acronym. I forget what it exactly stands for, but it's like someone back in something called a forward operating base or something. Basically someone chilling in the rear, you know, while all the action was going on elsewhere, you know?
Right.
But it was this big sprawling satire comedic novel about the Iraq War, the recent Iraq War from like the 2000s, and, you know, 2010s era. No way that book wouldn't have existed without Catch-22. I remember like all the blurbs compared it to Catch-22. So those are some books for me. What about you?
Well, to pick up on that, even though I did not read the book Fobbit, and I remember you reading it, but I researched it a little bit, which is to say like 5 minutes, you know, and I came, you know, because I was just curious, and I came across a review from The Guardian, the UK newspaper, of the book Fobbit. And I thought I would read the last couple of paragraphs just to, I was going to do this anyway, but they just totally, you know, emphasize and underline what you just said. And, the review is.
I want to say one thing about Fobbit I forgot to say, but the review might say it, so go on.
Yeah, the review is actually quite critical of the book and particularly critical of the acclaim that it got in the United States. But just, you know, it's very germane to this whole discussion, but it's the last couple of paragraphs say, Fobbit comes from the States well-praised. The New York Times Book Review offering the absurd judgment that it's, quote, as funny, disturbing, heartbreaking, and ridiculous as war itself, end quote. I think the desire to find Iraq's Catch-22, to wish it into existence, is the father to that thought. Fobbit's debt to Catch-22 is very deep indeed. Joseph Heller is among those thanked in the afterword for, quote, paving the road and lighting the street lamps. And Abrams apes Heller's jaunty absurdism, whimsical character names, and even the habit of naming chapters after characters. At one point, I slightly winced to see it, Staff Sergeant Gooding starts discussing Catch-22 with Shrinkle. Anyway, two characters in the novel Fobbit, I guess. And it ends this way. It's not an insult to Abrams to say that Fobbit suffers badly from the comparison it invites. As Heller is said to have replied when someone pointed out that he'd never written anything else as good as Catch-22, quote, who has? Question mark. Like, and that's the end of the review of Fobbit. But it also speaks to... you know, the enduring impact of Catch-22, and I guess Joseph Heller's opinion of his own novel.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like it's too unfounded either. But the thing I was going to point out about Fobbit, and those are really interesting comments about it. That's a different book. But the most Catch-22 moment in Fobbit, I hate to give a spoiler, but, like, you know, is what it is. I'm not sure how many people are reading it. But, like, there's a character that's, like, in one point in that book that I remember, because I usually forget everything about books I've read, you know, 5 minutes after I've read them. But there's one character in that book that's, like, literally in the rear with the gear, as we used to say in the Army. And he's in the theater of war, but he's chilling out at the pool. And he's on the pool in, like, this floating chair. He's literally sitting on the pool in the floating chair. But the base gets bombed, and the bomb lands directly on top of him in the pool. On this floating chair while he's chilling out with, like, a margarita or something, you know, like a direct hit in the middle of the pool.
Oh, geez.
So, you know, that's kind of like, you know, the type of book it is. But anyway, certainly Catch-22 was like the forebear to many, many other works like that. And you might have had more you wanted to hit on, do you?
Yeah, I do have a couple. And then, you know, we can wrap this up. Because I think we've talked about Catch-22 quite a bit here. But, I was just thinking as I was like two-thirds through the book, I'm like, you know, I can't really think of that many other war novels that are just madcap farces that are just have this comic tone. And I realized that, you know, there are a few others. And apparently one of the books that really influenced Joseph Heller and has a similar tone is a book called, I don't know how to say this. I'm sure you read about it too, but it's a book by a Eastern European writer named Yaroslav Hasek. I'm sure I'm butchering the pronunciations here, and it's called The Good Soldier Svek. I don't know, S-V-E-J-K. I just don't know how to pronounce that in, you know, sort of Slavic type language. But anyway, that's I've never read that novel, but I know it precedes Catch-22, and I know it was a huge influence on Catch-22. So that makes me curious, you know. And there was another book that was a really big influence on Catch-22, and that's a pretty famous book as well, called Journey to the End of Night by a French writer named Céline. Mm-hmm. That book has been sitting on my shelf for a long time, and I've, you know, many times I've almost picked it up. So I don't know much about it, so I can't really speak to it, but I think it would be interesting to read that and, you know, kind of discover, you know, what Catch-22 might have in common with it. But really the main book that I have read that came to mind, and I think there, you know, there are lots of points of comparison between these two writers and their books, would be one of Kurt Vonnegut's books called Slaughterhouse-Five. Vonnegut's not a writer that's come up a lot in this podcast, but he's one of the American greats and truly unique. I think both of us have only read a few books by him, I think, but I think we've both read Slaughterhouse-Five. Is that correct?
Yes.
So Slaughterhouse-Five has a different tone, but it's definitely comic because it's Kurt Vonnegut and he's hilarious. And it's definitely dark because it describes Kurt Vonnegut, you know, sort of famously survived or was involved somehow or close to the bombing at Dresden, the firebombing of Dresden, the German city. And right. That comes up, that's sort of described quite vividly and horrifically in Slaughterhouse-Five. But Slaughterhouse-Five also involves, like, aliens. And, you know, the famous sentence, it might be the opening sentence of the novel, you know, Billy Pilgrim has become unstuck in time. So, like, the main character sort of jumps back and forth in time. So there's, like, a weird sci-fi element to it. But I remember really appreciating not just the humor, but just the wild imagination that went into that book. And yet at the same time, that book punched you below the belt hard, you know, many times. And it really brought home the trauma that Kurt Vonnegut himself was dealing with from having served during World War II overseas. So that to me is a very important touch point when talking about Catch-22. And it's, you know, we're talking about where Catch-22 falls. It's been a long time since I read it, but I think personally, as much as I appreciate Catch-22, I think the Slaughterhouse-Five is kind of like sees what Catch-22 is doing and raises it 100. It's just, it's even more absurd and it's very visceral and it had a greater impact on me than Catch-22 did. It's also significantly shorter. So, you know, props to Vonnegut. And it's interesting as a side note too, that, you know, when we were talking about to our uncle about Catch-22, well, his favorite writer in the world is Kurt Vonnegut. So, and he and I talked very briefly about both of those writers and how, you know, some of their books really, you know, belong right next to each other on the shelf, so to speak. So I think that's interesting. And that's about it. I mean, there was a book that Dennis Johnson wrote, the great American writer who's passed away now, Dennis Johnson, wrote sort of late in his career. You know where I'm going with this. And it was about the Vietnam War, and it was called Tree of Smoke. And right. That was nowhere near like a madcap farce like Catch-22 is, but it did have this kind of vaguely funny, you know, current to it, while also being I mean, we've talked about this before. I don't think on the podcast, but that's got to be the best titled book in the world, because like, it's just the whole book is a Tree of Smoke. It's like there, but not there. And it's very vague and you have no idea what we're really getting at, which right. seems to be a great metaphor for Vietnam in general. You know, like,
yeah,
what was the mission again? And how do we know that we've achieved it? And, you know, it didn't end. It just kind of petered out, you know, like, or faded like smoke does into the wind, you know? So that was another book that came to mind. It's a big, long, thick book, but it doesn't nearly have the comedic flavor that Catch-22 does, but it is definitely absurd. And it has some very funny moments in it that you and I still quote to each other. So, you know, Tree of Smoke yeah. is the other book that came to mind for me.
I remember, just to close on my side on this, like, just as a story that I was told by that novelist named Stephen Wright, who wrote Meditations in Green. And I can't remember if this worked his way into the book or not, but he told me a story about being in Vietnam. And he worked as an intelligence specialist, so he was kind of back somewhere in a building, like scrutinizing maps with like these magnifying glasses or scopes or whatever, and trying to identify targets. And they were visited in that building by one of the top generals in the field who wanted to see what they were doing. And he came over to the table where like Private Stephen Wright was like sitting, and he gave him this whole speech about the importance of what he was doing and how noble it was and good for America, et cetera, et cetera. The problem was the guy was absolutely reeking with alcohol when he gave the speech.
Wow.
Like he was like soaked in alcohol and stinking up the whole room with alcohol. And I remember Stephen Wright telling me that's how he knew that the whole thing was like this effed, doomed enterprise right there. In that
Holy
moment.
Shit.
You know, this guy giving him this big rah-rah speech while just like literally excreting alcohol and vapors out of his body, you know? And that right there, the total insanity and absurdity and all in one moment, you know?
That's incredible.
That's incredible.
And it's
yeah.
also
pretty. Yeah, I mean,
I'm yeah. sorry?
I'm sorry?
No, I didn't. I cut you off. I didn't hear the last part of your.
Well, it's also pretty amazing that you got that directly from the mouth of the writer of Meditations in Green. So that's a great place to end. Why don't we just end it right there with that anecdote? Because that's really amazing and powerful and kind of like, you know, just ties back to some of the major themes in Catch-22. So
yeah, works for me.
Yeah. I hope listeners enjoyed this discussion of the book, and, you know, we knew that it would be take us down all kinds of paths, and there's plenty of rich material here. And I think we would both recommend the book to anyone who's interested in certainly in American literature or war literature. We recommend it with some reservations to anybody who's female, but at the same time, I think, you know, discerning readers of any gender can be able to kind of discern and see through, you know, what may be dated and what may be valuable in the book. So,
Or from any country.
So that wraps up our discussion of Catch-22. We're just going to wrap things up in general here for the episode. But as always, we look forward to what we're going to be reading next. Now, Jude, you just told us earlier in the show that you're, you know, immersed in this anthology. It's going to take you a good long time, I think, to get to the end of that book. Do you have anything in your sights for after that? Or is it just too far away at this point?
Good insight there. Yeah, no, I don't know. I imagine next time we record, I'll still be reading it. So I don't really have a title, but I would just say that I think I may get, you know, this subject to change. I may turn in a nonfiction direction, and I have a specific thought about why, but it relates to an episode that we're going to be doing, not next, but down the pike. So I may turn to nonfiction, but I really have no idea because I still have 900, 800 and something pages to read in the horror anthology. So you're right on target there. What about you?
Well, and partly because I'm in a similar situation, I described that I'm like right in the dead in the middle of this Frederick Douglass biography. So I'm going to be on that for quite a while, But I did decide what I'm planning to read next, which is a total curveball from anything we've discussed in this episode whatsoever.
Nice.
But I think you in particular are going to be, I haven't told you about this at all yet, but you in particular are going to be pretty interested because this is an author that I know you've read before, but I have definitely never read. So this will be a new experience for me, kind of like Catch-22. I have not read a good collection of short fiction in quite a while. So I kind of looked at, you know, my list, what I've been reading this year, and I realized that. And so I did what I often do. I went to my own shelves, and I have a book from the, speaking of the Modern Library, I have a book from the Modern Library, their paperback, you know, classics. And it's simply called Selected Stories. And the writer is the great British short story writer, V.S. Pritchett. So,
Wow, cool.
I'm going to read a volume of his stories. I know very little about him. I know you've read him before and have been impressed with what you've read from him. I know he was a very influential writer for many 20th century and beyond writers, but I know very, very little about his work. So I just happen to have it on my shelf and you know, I thought, well, no time like the present. So that's what I'm going to take on after Frederick Douglass.
That's really cool. I know very little about him too. I've read one or two books, but he's one of those guys that's like a sort of a William Trevor, like from Ireland.
Yeah,
it's like a person who spent their entire lifetime just kind of a very long life, you know, sort of exemplifying the craft of being a fiction writer. And strangely enough, I actually have a biography of him on my shelf, which I bought without knowing anything about him and not even knowing most of his works, but I just knew he was a guy who, like, wrote tons of fiction and was considered one of the great masters. And I thought, well, that's good enough for me.
Yeah.
So I haven't read the biography, but someday I will, just because I know he was, like, a master. But, yeah, I'll be interested to hear what you think. I, you know, who knows?
didn't you read, like, some kind of nonfiction book about him, though, or about somebody who had a friendship with him? Or am I making that up?
I believe I might be getting this wrong. I read a book. I believe he wrote a book about Franz Kafka.
Oh, okay.
Might be wrong about that. And I read his book about Franz Kafka.
Okay.
And then I read at least one collection of stories and one novel, obscure novel, called The Camberwell Beauty. But anyway, yeah. Like, he's somebody who's, like, just basically forgotten in most circles. But, like, I know he was, like, just this guy that spent his whole life kind of like a William Trevor, you know, one of those people, just, or a Eudora Welty or something, just like,
right,
writing fiction.
Or Peter Taylor.
Yeah, right.
Anyway, I, you know, every once in a while I just like to just choose something for myself and a writer I know absolutely nothing about but has a reputation and just see what happens. So that's what I'll be doing. And that leaves us to do only one more thing here on episode 57. And that is Tease episode 58. I'm going to throw that over to you. Why don't you do the honors?
All right, cool. Yeah, this is going to be a lot of fun. So we sort of inadvertently started a series some time ago without knowing that we started a series. And then we figured out that it could be a series. So this is actually going to be the second in that series. Oh, I'm getting a little echo now too. Fun. But anyway, you still hear me?
Yep.
Okay. So some time ago we did an episode, I would just call it like kind of the exclamation point series, I guess. We did an episode that we called Monsters with an exclamation point because we were doing an episode on monsters, right? So you got to use an exclamation point there. And then at some point after we took the break or during the break where we couldn't get the app right, which we still are working on, where we were not doing the podcast for 8 months, we decided to turn that into a series. So the series is, the common thread is the exclamation point. So we're going to do our second in that series next week, and the episode is going to be called, episode 58, Ghosts with an exclamation point. And I can't wait. I mean, so the point is, you know, you have the broad topic. You can take it any which way you want it, as long as it sort of applies to the broad theme of specters or, you know, or ghosts, or, you know, figures, you know, from the other side or however you want to say it. So that's going to be great. I have no idea what I'm going to be covering in that episode, but I can't wait to kind of dig in.
Yeah, same thing here. And you might even be collecting some material for that discussion in the anthology you're reading now.
Absolutely. And there's a book I want to get. I don't know if I'll fit it in time before the episode, particular to this theme, but we'll see. But there's plenty of ground to cover. So that's our episode coming up, Ghosts. So don't miss it.
Yeah. I mean, you've already tipped a hand, so to speak, at one of the writers that I'm definitely going to bring up during that discussion, which is M.R. James. So he has a whole series of very famous ghost stories, a few of which are just incredible. Anyway, that's what's coming up next. But for now, thanks a lot, as always, for listening to the Book Exchange. We really appreciate anybody who spends time with us and, you know, fills their ears with our banter, even if it's just for a little while, or even if you feel like it's too long. We appreciate everyone just kind of supporting the show. Until next time, it's Jude and John signing off for the Book Exchange podcast.
Yeah, thank you all for listening. I want to point out to the listeners that this is coming in sort of well under 2 hours, at least by our standards. So go us. But thank you for listening. Really appreciate it. And we'll be back next time.
So long, everybody.